Hello. Welcome to the Oregon Zero Suicide Podcast Series. I'm Dr. Susan Keyes, and today I'm with Allie Linfoot, Peer Services Coordinator for Clackamas County Behavioral Health. Peer support is a unique aspect of Zero Suicide that leverages the lived experiences of peers as part of the system of care for someone experiencing mental health issues. We're here today to hear from Allie about her experiences as a peer supporter, as well as her role in developing the Clackamas County Peer Support Program. But before we begin, Allie, can you tell us about your background and what brings you to this work?
Sure. I came to this kind of work, in fact, came to mental health and learning about our mental health systems through my son, who is 28 now. But at the time, he was about seven when I really became active in making sure the needs of children who were struggling with their mental health were recognized. And over time, I worked on that issue and never disclosing my own experiences, having bipolar disorder and struggling with depression and raising children at the same time and all of that. And it came from a place of knowing that if I disclosed that information, it would limit my ability to advocate for my son because of stigma that exists out there. So it wasn't until about 10 years ago that I started talking about my own experiences.
Great. So your own experiences and experiences as an individual and as a mother has kind of brought you to this work.
Yes, absolutely. I've always tried to come at advocating for peer-delivered services through the lens, through a social justice lens and a human rights lens, fighting stigma around mental health, and pushing up against the fear that people who have or the fear that people often have when they don't understand mental health and what that means for somebody who struggles with it. And there's so much media and propaganda out there that is just not true around mental health. And it many times can bring fear up in people, which prevents people then from finding the compassion in themselves for people who are struggling.
Well, let's find out more about how this passion that you have for kind of stomping down stigma turned into this work as a peer supporter. And why don't we just start talking about what is a peer support program? Because some of our members of our audience might be new to them. It might not be something that's a part of their systems of care. And, you know, just tell us a little bit about what that type of program is.
Okay. So here in Clackamas, we have 17 peer support programs. These programs provide support to people who are struggling with mental health and or addiction. The people who provide the support are people with lived experience of their own mental health or their own addictions who are now in recovery. And they work closely as a supporter for somebody who is working towards recovery themselves. These programs come in lots of different shapes and sizes. We have programs that some of them are very specific to the systems that they partner with. So, for example, we have peers that go into our jail several times a week to work with people in the jail, both that may be struggling with an addiction and also with their mental health. We have another program very specific to parents who have children and end up in our emergency rooms. We have a family partner who can meet a family at the emergency room and help them navigate those systems and provide support and help them figure out what to do if their child is not admitted into the hospital. So we have programs like that too.
Excellent. So you mentioned a peer support program that's part of the jail system. So I'm surprised. I thought this was something that only functioned as part of the mental health system or the behavioral health system. So can you just say a little bit more about how in Clackamas County you've kind of spread your wings for peer support?
So we know that people who have mental health issues, they touch many, many other systems than just behavioral health. We know that people struggling with mental health and or addiction, they cycle in and out of our jail all the time. We have people that come in on a Friday, leave on a Tuesday, and the guy that lets them out the door says, we'll see you on Friday. You know, we know that this happens. So in an attempt to stop that revolving door, and we know that the best place for somebody to get to recovery is not jail, attempting to slow that revolving door, we wanted peers to be able to come into the jail to meet with people. Some of them are there very short term, just a few days. Some are there for 30, 60, 90 days, up to a year. And the peers can run a curriculum in the jail. And sometimes people in the jail are like, well, it gets me out of my cell. It gives me something to do. So they go. But that's fantastic because that gives the peer a chance to engage with them then, to talk to them about recovery. Then when that person is discharged from the jail or released from the jail, they can be met at the door by a peer. And when we're talking about people who struggle with both mental health and addiction, we know that stepping out of that door outside, they are probably the most vulnerable they're going to be, and there's a choice to be made. And sometimes the choice to go back into those slippery circles, back to the old places, that's the most comfortable place to go. Mm. So if you have a peer that meets you at the door and is willing to walk with you to try this new path, that makes the choice a little bit easier for people, I think.
Very powerful. Very powerful. Kind of switching back to the behavioral health system, give us a sense of how a peer support person might function within that system. And how do they get connected with a peer support person? How does that get recognized? Are they asked, would you like a peer support person? Or how does it get going? How does it get rolling?
So when we decide to enter into let me back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. All of these peer support services are provided by peer-run organizations. And they are organizations that we have contracts with. And part of their contract is to develop referral sources. Many of them are standalone programs. So you aren't going to walk into your psychiatrist's office and there's going to be a peer there, you know, to offer assistance. Hopefully that psychiatrist has the information on how you can connect with a peer. But we have this philosophy of no wrong door. So no matter where somebody enters, whether it's an emergency room, it's a psychiatric unit in a hospital, it's the jail, it's our crisis walk-in services, the people there know that peer-delivered services are available. They can make a referral. The person can self-refer, and they get hooked up then with a peer support specialist. We try to match people to peers that have similar lived experiences to the person who's looking for support. So we have lots of peers who their lived experience is both mental health and addiction. We have peers that it's just purely mental health has been their experience. And we have other peers that addiction has just been their experience. However, we do recognize lots of crossover, lots of trauma in all areas. So we like to to keep a nice deep pool of peers with vast lived experience.
I'm curious, how many are in your pool?
We have just over 100 working in the county. Mm-hmm. And that's in 17 programs. That includes really across the lifespan. So it's families with young children all the way up to, we have peers that specialize in older adult mental health. And they serve last year just over 7,000. We were about 7,200 people were served in peer support services.
That's amazing. Amazing.
It's more than what we show being served in our Medicaid system in our county.
Interesting.
And part of that is that our peer delivered services are not, you don't have to be insured. You don't have to be on Medicaid. You don't even have to be enrolled in treatment services somewhere. If peer support is what you're looking for and you're thinking that that might be most helpful to me, you can start with peer services. Or for some people, treatment, going to a clinic, seeing a therapist, that's where they want to start. That's okay, too. You can still get to peer support from there also.
Mm-hmm. And what does the peer support person do? Would they attend meetings with the person they're supporting? Do they just have coffee with them? Would they ever meet as part of their treatment team? I mean, how, just give us an
it's
idea.
All of the above. Peers, they really have a choice to make based on the person they're working with. It's the person they're working with who is going to guide what that peer support looks like. So for many of our programs, it is sitting down and having a conversation with the person. And some of it is goal setting. What is it that you're hoping to accomplish by working with me? And sometimes those are tasks that things we would expect to see. I want stable housing, or I would love to find a part-time job, or I want to volunteer somewhere. And peers can help with all of those things, connecting to the right places. And for some, it's helping them find their voice again. For some, particularly those that have been institutionalized much of their life, they have often lost their voice. And so the peer helps them find their voice again, helps them to become a good self-advocate, helps to model those skills for them. And sometimes for a time, a peer will become somebody else's voice for them until they find their own again.
Tell a little more about that. What does that mean?
Well,
what does that look like?
It's amazing what a person will tell their peer versus anybody else that's on their treatment team or their family members. And it comes from that sort of brotherhood or sisterhood of lived experience. Mm-hmm. And somebody could say, you know, here's a controversial one that I don't want to take my meds anymore. I don't feel good when I'm on them. I can't think clearly. I sleep too much, or, you know, whatever the issue may be. But I don't know how to tell my doctor that. I don't know how to tell my family that. I don't, you know. And so what the peer can do is help to broach that subject in the meeting, encourage that person to speak for themselves, talk about their concerns, and help them really navigate that whole process, and make sure and help them be heard by the rest of their team. And I use that example of medications because that is one where often can elicit fear in those that care about the person. And so it's usually one that is an attempt is made to shut that down right away and talk about why you shouldn't do that, instead of talking about, well, what would you like to do instead? How can we support you in that decision? And that's what the peer helps to do, is to create a more supportive atmosphere to have the conversation, and to support that person in their decision. Yeah.
As I listen to you speak, it seems that these peer supporters have a really good set of skills. And I'm wondering how those are acquired. Is there a training program? Do you look for natural aspects of helping? Or how do you get that package together?
Well, in Oregon, we do have a training process for people. You can we have lots of trainings that are certified through the state. For example, the one that we like here in Clackamas is Intentional Peer Support, created by Sherry Mead. You can get trained. You can be you can put yourself on a registry in the state of Oregon that will show the areas, the region you work in, what your skill sets are. So that's all recorded. You don't have to get on the registry if you don't want to. We do have some rules around that. If you are a peer that's going to, for example, bill Medicaid in your job, you must be on the registry to be able to do that. The training, you have to have a minimum of 40 hours. We have additional training for roles that we call peer wellness specialists, and those peers have an additional 40 hours training in physical health. So they work with lots of people who have mental health issues but also chronic physical illnesses, and helping that person, supporting them in getting the treatment that they need for that also. Mm-hmm. So yes, we do have training programs.
So let's talk a little bit more about what that training program looks like. You said 40 hours. That's a significant amount of time. Is that broken into course modules, or what's the curriculum look like?
So there are course modules. There is a set of core competencies. I'll talk about intentional peer support because that's the one I'm most familiar with. It's the one
Perfect.
I've been trained in.
Perfect.
Part of that is a big part of that is the mutuality and reducing that power differential as much as possible in that relationship with somebody. Because we know, as peer supporters, we are bound by certain rules that are in place by the state, things like confidentiality, mandatory reporting if we suspect abuse, you know, things like that. And those things all create a power differential in the relationship. So by using mutuality, we can reduce that as much as possible. And to do that, we share a lot of our own story. Training also teaches us when it's appropriate to share our own story. That can be a little dicey sometimes on when if I'm talking to somebody who is really struggling with something or maybe in some sort of crisis, I need to know, and often it's just learned through experience, whether or not it is appropriate to talk about when I went through this very same thing, this is what happened. Sometimes people appreciate that. Sometimes they look at you and go, this isn't about you. so just through experience and through training programs, you learn to kind of figure out when to do that. Mm-hmm. And you learn how to sometimes say nothing. Sometimes it's sitting with somebody in silence. And that's okay, too. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's crying with somebody and showing them that, yeah, I cry, too. Mm-hmm.
It's powerful, very powerful. You mentioned that sometimes it gets a little dicey. And it sounds like it's an important thing to have training and then ongoing contact with a supervisor or someone that's more experienced that the peer supporter gets to chat with and say, here's what's going on. And does that happen in your program?
So we're still developing good supervision guidelines for peers. That's something we've been working on for a while. On the peer support side, on the addiction side, I think it was 2 years ago now, we did release guidelines. I was part of a group of people who developed those. On the mental health side, we're still working on that. What we do know, and I think what we've learned here in Clackamas, is that co-supervision, so for a peer that's working in a clinic side by side with clinicians, billing Medicaid, there is a requirement that you, a peer, receive clinical supervision. We don't want peers to only have clinical supervision. What we find when that happens is that the line blurs between am I a mini clinician or a mini case manager versus a peer supporter. So with co-supervision, you have the required clinical supervision happen, but a peer supervisor is always present during the clinical supervision. The peer supervisor should always also be a peer with lived experience who has, some years of experience in doing direct peer support. So that's a model that we try to follow here in mm-hmm. Clackamas when we have peers that are in clinics and billing Medicaid mm-hmm. And being exposed to that medical model daily. And that helps for peers to stay in that peer spot mm-hmm. and not become too medicalized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that there's some billing for Medicaid. How does that work? Is this a service that Medicaid will reimburse for?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. In the state of Oregon, peers, we have our own Medicaid codes. The state has been working on moving towards peer-run organizations becoming Medicaid billable entities. There's some controversy around that. But if we get to that and that happens, we have to have many more codes developed for peer supports. Mm-hmm. Right now, much of what a peer does is not billable. And once you sort of move into that Medicaid world, you have to consider that revenue that's brought in to support the position. And what we worry about is then becoming medicalized and productivity becomes the issue. Mm-hmm. And because we know that that's what's happened mm-hmm. in the treatment field.
Mm-hmm. And really, really important observation and point. Yes. So how do your peer supporters get compensated? I mean, some may be through the Medicaid system, but it sounds like there's probably a lot of people doing a lot of work that's not billable. And you have these peer-run organizations. How are they funded? Are they funded through, I'll jump ahead here, through contracts with the county, or what's that look like?
So in Clackamas, we've kind of developed our own model of providing these services, and it is we pay for FTE. It's not fee for service. They're fairly simple contracts in that we need peers that can work with this population of people, can serve X number of people. It'll take 5 full-time positions to do that, and this is what we'll pay. And they're very simple. It's just FTE. Mm-hmm. And that way, it also creates some flexibility in employment for peers. We have lots of peers who work full-time. They're 40 hours a week. But we have lots of peers that's not healthy. Mm-hmm. They've discovered that they really can only work, say 20 hours a week. Mm-hmm. And so our peer-run organizations are able to create positions where peers can work 10 hours a week, 20 hours a week, or 40 hours a week, whatever works for them and allows them to also remain in a place of wellness. And that also is a whole other thing. In our contracts, we do require that our contractors provide flexible staffing so that their peers do have the ability to take self-care when they need to, that they're able to work the hours that works well with their health. And so there needs to be those flexible ways of working instead of sort of your traditional 40 hours a week, you know, Monday through Friday, that sort of thing.
That's really great. It just sounds like a really, really super program. I'm sure you're really proud of it. And you should be.
I am. But I had a lot of help. And right now, we've been doing this for 9 years now, almost 9 years. And our contractors are really the one that carry the system now. Mm-hmm. They have the referral sources. They know how to get things done. They're great self-advocates for their peers to be able to get into places where historically they haven't been able to go before, like jails, et cetera. So, yeah.
That's great. What you said, 6 years or 9 years? I can't remember what you said.
Almost nine.
So there must have been some lessons learned along the way.
Yeah.
And what do you think would be some of the important ones for our audience to hear?
I think when you're bringing peers into a system who may not be familiar with who they are, all they know is that these are people with mental health diagnoses or are in recovery from addiction or both. Doing some training with our system partners is critical in understanding what mental health is, what addiction is, what that means for a person who experiences that. Let them educate them on what the skill sets are for a peer, exactly what that role should look like. Because we see, if you don't do that, we see all kinds of issues come up later around peers or people perceiving that peers are not staying in their own lane, that toes are getting stepped on, or we see, what do we call it, like scope creep.
Mm-hmm.
We see peers wandering out of their scope of work. Mm-hmm. So it's that initial training is critical, and ongoing training and sort of care and nurturing of those relationships is critical also.
So it's training not just for the peer supporter, but it's training for the systems in which they're going to be embedded.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, so exactly.
Really important. Anything else that would be a lesson learned?
There are some systems we have worked with that I think that they feel it's their duty to provide the guidance and the direction and the supervision for peers, and it's not. A best practice is to contract with a peer-run organization. That way, when that peer has to do some advocacy for the person they're supporting, there is no fear of getting fired. There's no fear of getting a bad annual evaluation by your supervisor. That fear is gone so that they're able to effectively advocate. And that is because they're backed by an organization who understands what peer support looks like and the values behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And that organization is the one that is responsible for holding their peers accountable for the job that they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we get some conflicts once in a while on who really is in charge of the peers. But that's that care and nurturing that needs to continue to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's just making sure we're communicating and that everybody's receiving the information they need to be able to support and make sure that these roles happen the way they should happen.
And that leads me to think that your role as a coordinator must be aligned with some of those things that you've just said, kind of that walking between the organization that's you're contracting with as well as the systems in which these people are embedded. So for someone who might be listening who's saying, gee, this sounds like a program we'd like to have, Can you say a little bit more about what your role is and why that's important to this program?
Mm-hmm. I was just having a conversation with somebody this morning about this, how my role here in Clackamas is technically a program planner and a contract manager. But it's so much more than that because of the types of contracts that I manage. So I have to ensure that the organizations we contract with are providing the deliverables that they agreed to, that they're sending in reports on time, that when we ask to come in and review the program, that we're able to do that. And the other part of my job, and probably the bigger part of my job, is I also within the county am an advocate for that contractor. Because these are programs and positions that are so little understood in the community, there's a lot of advocacy that needs to happen on my part to make sure that these programs can get into our system partners, get into the jail, get into the treatment centers, get into the hospitals. And that requires me to be an advocate within the county system and working with my colleagues in the county to better understand what these roles mean for people.
You know, listening to you, Allie, I have to say that I think your passion for this work has significantly contributed to what I suspect is its excellence.
Thank you. Well, I did get a little teary earlier.
I saw that.
But it is a passion, and it's very personal for me because mm-hmm. I've struggled with these things myself. I've watched my child struggle with these things. I know we're supposed to, as professionals, with my little air quotes, we're supposed to separate ourselves from that and not take it personally. But because I've lived so much of it, it's very hard not to take it personally. Mm-hmm. What I have to do in me is find my compassion for those who don't understand mm-hmm. what it means to live with this, what it means to want to help and support and provide these types of supports for people. So it's a hard job. I go home exhausted almost every night.
It is a hard job, but I think just listening to your passion and your commitment and your vision, I think all of those, as well as your lived experience, are significant factors in why this works. And I just think it sounds like really, really good work, hard work, but job well done.
Thank you.
We're about ready to close. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about what you do or your program?
Asked a question about funding, mm-hmm. and I do want people to know that my programs are not funded in the traditional sense of billing Medicaid. Lots of my programs are funded with Medicaid dollars, but like I said, we pay for FTE. But braided funding is super, super important. So it's not just Medicaid money, but it's also tapping into the marijuana tax dollars, beer and wine tax dollars, children's mental health, adult mental health, and braiding all of these things together creates a flexibility for the peers to be able to do the work the way it should happen. And they don't get stuck in this Medicaid box of mm-hmm. Billing. So I just want to stress that.
Yeah, and I'm glad you clarified that. I think that's a significant point. And it's many different kinds of dollars that need to come together and support a program like this.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And I'll thank our listeners for being with us today. And this is Dr. Susan Keyes saying so long with Allie Linford from Clackamas County.